Hi, this is Frank Simon with the rest of the news, and our special guest today is Jim Waters. Tell us the name of your...
Well, thanks, Dr. Simon. I'm the president of the Bluegrass Institute for Public Policy Solutions. Long name, amazing results, BIPS.org, B-I-P-P-S. You can find my weekly columns on there that go out across the state, and a whole lot of other information about free market solutions to Kentucky's problems.
Okay. What can you tell us about what's going on in Frankfort, like the retirement and pension crisis and all that?
Well, it's been an interesting session with that, particularly with the pension issue. One of the things that was passed during this session was pension reform.
Yeah.
And it was designed to stop the bleeding of our pension system. We have a serious issue. Our pension systems are, depending on who you talk to, they're between $45 and $60 billion underwater. That's $48,000 per Kentucky taxpayer right now that the liability is, the unfunded liability for the pension system.
Really?
It's one of the worst in the country. It's caused our credit rating as a state to be downgraded, which means that everything we do costs more. We build a new school, it costs more. We build a new justice center, it costs more. All of those things cost more. And if we're going to stop that decline, there needed to be a serious reform measure passed. House Bill 151 was originally a wastewater treatment bill, believe it or not. But because of the way the legislature works, they could not introduce a new bill in the final days of the legislature. They have 2 days left, but really the final working days that they had. So they took this bill that was already on the orders of the day, they gutted it and put it in the pension reform measure. A lot of people don't like that, but that's the way the legislature works. And that's just how it works. And the legislators are getting criticized for that. It was either that or do nothing. And do nothing here is not an option because our pension systems are already getting close to being underwater altogether.
Okay, let's see. I think we have a caller just a minute,
okay.
Jim. And okay, is this the caller? Right. And it seems to me that Hitler was the one that was against guns. Right, right. Okay, let's see. That's this Saturday. 4:14, is that right? At the Capitol in Frankfort on the back lawn. Okay, Jeff, I appreciate your good work. Appreciate you calling in because someone says the Second Amendment is the one that keeps us from losing all the others. Right, right. Okay, thank you very much for calling in and bringing that to us, our attention.
The numbers indicate, by the way, that Kentucky's the most armed state in America. I mean, we believe in the Second Amendment.
Is that right?
Anybody that comes here, whether they're a presidential candidate or congressional candidate or whatever, they better be on board with that. I mean, you don't even hear John Yarmuth out there really trying to take our guns away. He might believe that personally, but he's real careful about what he says about that, even in a liberal city like Louisville. I like that, though. The Second Amendment guarantees the other rights. And Dr. Simon, our founders were concerned that the citizens could take back their government from tyranny, that we had the means. And if you take away the weapons, which is what Hitler and other dictators have done, when you take those away, you take away the ability of the people to reclaim their liberty and reclaim their government. And that's what he did. And that's what happened. Look at what happened in Nazi Germany, and not just there, other countries as well.
Right.
We need to be very careful about allowing this erosion to take place of our rights, of our inalienable rights in particular.
Right. That's very important. Okay. What can you tell us about what's going on in Frankfort?
Well, the pension bill that was passed, what it does is it stops the bleeding on this liability. We were talking about this huge liability that the state has. And all of these great things that the legislature passed last year, like right to work and repeal of prevailing wage, paycheck protection for workers, pension transparency for the legislative pension system, all these, some pro-life bills, all and charter schools, all these bills were great, but no business wants to come to Kentucky. No job creator wants to come here and bail out our pension system.
Right.
And here's the reality of this is the Kentucky employees retirement system was almost 140% funded just in the year 2000. And now it's 14%, barely 13% funded. It has declined that quickly. The level of funding in that system has almost totally declined to the point of insolvency. So if we continue to add it to those liabilities, that makes that funding level go down very quickly.
So in other words, the government, the legislature, had promised certain people that they would give them a lot of money for their retirement.
Well, what happened really was we had a defined benefit system that if the rules were followed, we wouldn't have unfunded liabilities. But the rules were not followed. And what I mean by that is the rules such as once a benefit is determined and awarded for that year, you can't come back and increase it without creating unfunded liabilities. But that's exactly what the politicians working in conjunction with the actuaries did. They came back and raised benefits not only for the year we're in now, maybe, but they applied those increases to all the past years that people had been in the system and then promised the same level of benefits in the future. These were benefits that were not properly pre-funded and that we absolutely could not afford. And so we made promises we couldn't keep. Now, I don't blame the beneficiaries for that. They're the ones, the promises were made to them. And they're absolutely right about that. They really were. But on the other hand, what we asked them to do initially for this session was basically to give up $15 to $20 a month would have been all it would have been for to give up this, for example, to allow us to lower the automatic cost of living increases that retirees receive from 1.5% to 1%. Well, there's a great example right there in that one benefit of what's happened to the whole system. When the cost of living was implemented, when that was first created, it was 1%. And it was properly funded. It was planned for. It was pre-funded before it was awarded. All of the things that are supposed to happen in the defined benefit pension system. But politicians came along later and they wanted to curry favor with the teachers unions, with the group, different groups that vote especially progressively and left. So they increased that cost of living arbitrarily. It wasn't properly funded. The money wasn't there, but it bought votes for these guys. Most of them are long gone now. So they haven't been around to pay the piper. It's almost like the former legislators had a big party and they all got smashed, and then the current legislators have to clean up the hangover. But they really spent like drunken sailors, is what we said. But now we're left holding the bag, and this is what we said. The can's going to stop with us. And during this session, what they did do, though, was they changed the policy on sick days, for example, for current teachers. No longer will current teachers, when they retire, be able to not only get a check for their unused sick days, but embed the amount of that benefit, which is sometimes as high as $20,000, into the formula which causes their pensions for a lifetime to increase. And this was costing us $34 million a year, just that one benefit. So we were able to get rid of that. And plus, we created a new pension plan for new employees. And what this is a cash balance plan. So teachers, for example, will contribute 9.105% is exactly what it is, a little over 9%, which is what they're contributing now. The employers, the state, will give 6%. Local school districts will contribute 2%. Then people in that system will get 85% of the investment credit. The returns that are in the positive after the administrative fees and all that are settled, the net of that, they will get 85% of that into their accounts. The state will hold on to 15% in order to guarantee those workers that their accounts will never drop below zero, that their returns will never be lower. They will never lose. Their accounts will never lose money. So this is still a very generous benefit, but it protects the taxpayers from these unfunded liabilities, where the politicians can come in, increase the benefits, apply that retroactively, promise it prospectively in the future, and create these unfunded liabilities. So we have gone a long way to stopping the bleeding, which is what we had to do, to use a medical analogy. But we had to do that, and we didn't just put a Band-Aid on it. We actually did do some significant things. New teachers coming into the system will have to teach longer before they're eligible for retirement. And there still may need to be some things in the future done with current employees. But I think the legislators were somewhat intimidated by some of the groups on the left. And to their credit, they showed up in great numbers at the Capitol. It's hard to ignore 1,000 people in the rotunda yelling, and 5 people you can hear in that rotunda, but 1,000, they showed up. And these are not the majority of Kentuckians, but they certainly made the most noise. So,
well, now, I have a retirement fund, and I ask myself, how much money did the teachers put into my retirement fund? Okay, The answer is not one red cent. So then the next question is, why should I put my money into the teacher's retirement fund?
Well, that's particularly true now. At one time when these systems began, it is a fact that public workers' salaries were lower than what they could earn in the private sector, and sometimes significantly so. And so the idea of creating a defined benefit plan, which is basically an assured benefit, was to be able to attract people, good people, that were qualified to work in these positions. That's no longer the case.
Let me play you a clip from the teachers' union, the NEA.
Let's see. And that brings me to my final and most important point.
Okay, let me introduce it. This is the attorney for the NEA, the National Education Association. And he's speaking to a convention of teachers. It's just about a minute long. Let's see what he has to say.
That brings me to my final and most important point, which is why, at least in my opinion, NEA and its affiliates are such effective advocates. Despite what some among us would like to believe, it is not because of our creative ideas. It is not because of the merit of our position. It is not because we care about children, and it is not because we have a vision of a great public school for every child. NEA and its affiliates are effective advocates because we have power. And we have power because there are more than 3.2 million people who are willing to pay us hundreds of millions of dollars in dues each year because they believe that we are the unions that can most effectively represent them, the unions that can protect their rights and advance their interests as education employees. This is not to say that the concern of NEA and its affiliates with closing achievement gaps, reducing dropout rates, improving teacher quality, and the like are unimportant or inappropriate. To the contrary, these are the goals that guide the work we do. But they need not and must not be achieved at the expense of due process, employee rights, and collective bargaining. That simply is too high a price to pay.
So notice there, Dr. Simon, if I could make a real clear observation here, that this is not about kids. The unions are not about the kids. When Tony Bennett took over as Indiana's superintendent of public instruction, well, he got elected. Over there, they elect their top person. The first thing he said, I'm going to do is start a new union. He said, I'm going to start the union for Indiana's kids.
Yeah.
And when the mission and vision of my union contradicts with the mission and vision of the NEA or the teachers unions, I'm going with the kids. This whole discussion about the retirement system, about the pension system, the teachers have desperately tried to convince us that it's about the kids. But here's the deal. The reason that's not flying is the NEA, which is that same organization.
Right here.
Yeah. They did surveys of teacher salaries, and they determined that Kentucky teachers make on average, the career teachers here, over $51,000 a year. That is significantly higher than even the average income of Kentuckians, okay? And it's 26th in the nation. Now, that did not take into account other things like cost of living and the benefits that they're now receiving. NPR, remember, I'm not talking here about right-wing organizations. I'm talking about left-wing organizations. I'm talking about progressives. Yeah, I'm talking about pro-union organizations.
National Public Radio.
National Public Radio. They did some more work on this and said, actually, it's higher than that, that the Kentucky teachers get paid 7th in the nation. Now, to go along with what you're saying about what you're making and what you're being forced to contribute, the per capita income of Kentuckians ranks number 47. That means only 3 states in America have lower incomes than Kentuckians, and yet we're paying our teachers 26th in the nation, in the middle of the pack, and we're actually, when you figure in the benefits, generous benefits, they're 7th in the country. Now, they're saying that if we change or reform our system, which to the, really would equal what we were asking for, would equal about $15 to $20 a month, that we would discourage people from going into the teaching profession in Kentucky, and that we just hated teaching and we didn't like teachers. But here's the deal is, we did analysis on the cash balance plan that has passed. Largely, it was what was passed. And what we discovered was that a teacher, say, in Franklin County, Frankfort, Kentucky, the capital of Kentucky, she begins at 27 years old. She teaches 30 years. Under this new plan, her account will have more than $717,000 in the account. She will get an average annual annuitized benefit of $62,000 a year. I dare say that if we advertise those kind of benefits, I don't think we're going to have any problem attracting teachers to Kentucky. Do you? I really don't. But my point is, this hasn't been about the kids. Now, teachers say it is, but here's what we found here in Jefferson County. Okay, we only have 18% of our high school African-American students are performing proficiently or perform proficiently on the 2016-17 K-PREP state testing scores. We just put this together. This is the second time today only that I've mentioned this. 82% of our minority students in this county, where we are right now, where we're sitting in this school district, only 18% of them, 82%, are failing to reach proficiency. Only 18% of our high school students are graduating prepared in math, only 19% in science, only 32% in reading, only 35% in social studies. I mean, we're talking here about tens of thousands of kids that are being left behind in the district in Kentucky, where teacher salaries, by the way, are at the top of the heap, and spending on education is at the top of the heap in Kentucky, and the benefits are at the top of the heap. We've got 365 people. We're not only paying six-figure salaries at the central office here, but we're paying their pensions. Nope, they don't want to talk about it, these protests. They never talk about how we're performing academically, right, which is, in your profession, my profession, we're judged based on our performance, okay?
Right.
What they
right.
want us to judge on is based on our emotion for teachers and some feeling for teachers, and that can't be the way it is. We're talking here about real money.
Let me say this. America used to have the best schools in the world. We, instead of being number one, we're 25th and falling all the time. And all of this happened when they took God out of our public schools. Of course, we have all the drug problem. We have all the children murdering children problem. We've got all kinds of problems in our schools today. Now, if the teachers would say, oh, we want to have the Ten Commandments back in our schools, or prayer, or creation science, I would.
There's another problem I want to add to that list. All those things are true.
Yeah.
But all of those industrialized countries that we're behind, we're down almost 30th.
Yeah.
All of them have school choice.
Yeah.
All of them allow parents. So
what
that looks like here is, if parents want their children to go to a school that teaches their values and their faith and their belief in all those countries, they can do it. And we can't do it here. And another thing that does is, that makes their public system, or the biggest one, makes it perform at a higher level, which affects everybody.
Yeah,
and that's what's missing here. We don't have that.
We need school choice.
We need it. And this legislature has fallen down on the job on this. During the last session, Dr. Simon, they passed a bill allowing charter schools. This time, they took funding for charter schools out of the budget, and they have not included that. And really, people need to call their legislators on this and say, you pass charter schools, but you're essentially saying you don't support them if you don't support funding for them, because without that, no one's going to be attracted to start charter schools in this state. You've got to have the funding for it. And another thing they have not done, which they need to do, is scholarship tax credits for, so that particularly low-income minority families, or even white, low-income white families in this state, can send their children to a Christian school or to a private school and have a scholarship to do that and be able to afford that. Why should so many of these kids be left behind just because their parents don't make a lot of money, when we're spending in this district $1.5 billion this year on public education in this district? We're spending twice as much as the Metro Council will spend for government, all of government.
Kentucky is.
I'm talking about the Jefferson County Public Schools budget this year.
$1.5 billion.
$1.5 billion. And yet we've got 8,614 low-income African-American students who will graduate below proficiency in math out of the 10,505 total black students. less than 2,000 of the black students in this community will be proficient in math when they graduate from high school. They're getting paid. Where's the return on investment here? Where's the return that taxpayers make on this? Where's the return on that?
Well, I would like to see the teachers work to put God back in our schools, because it was right after they took God out, prayer out, the Ten Commandments out, creation science out.
And then told parents, you can't send your children to schools that teach those.
Yeah.
And so either they got to get that back, which you're right, it began to decline. There's no question when that happened.
Yeah.
But they also at the same time said that just parents, we know better than you. The government will decide where your kids are educated. And it's been a disaster. Put all that together, and it's a disaster. In Jefferson County, I mean, low-income kids, only 25% of low-income, free and reduced lunch kids are getting a decent education here. 25%. That leaves a lot of kids behind. And without God, without prayer, without these moral values, part of education is preparing kids for the future. We've even seen in charter schools across the country where they're teaching these values. They're saying, hey, you want to come after us, come after us. But we're finding that a lot of these kids are coming to charter schools from broken homes, from drug-infested neighborhoods. What is it that's going to turn them around? Well, it's going to be an education, but it's also going to be some moral values and teaching and faith and all that, some discipline, all those things.
We've been down this road. We've gotten lost. We need to get back on the right road again. Right. And do what works.
But it's going to take people in Frankfort willing to stand up in the face of intimidation, in the face of threats, which they have faced. These protests had the Socialist Party flag. They were flying the Socialist Party flag at these protests. I have a picture of it on my Facebook account, and you can see it on there, and it got a lot of comments. So you have protesters allowing the Socialist Party USA flag. And then the response from them on there was, well, that's our First Amendment rights. Well, what about our First Amendment rights as Christians, right?
Right.
To stand up for what we believe in. Do you think they would allow the Christian flag to be flown there? Do you think they would allow Dr. Simon to set up a table or the Bluegrass Institute to set up a table? But the Socialist Party had a table at the event. They had their tables.
We had a video in here that says a group of these people, they are yelling, chanting, no Trump, no wall, no USA at all. Okay, they just want to do...
And those are the people educating our kids. Not all teachers are that way. You want to say that. But, and I'm not anti-teacher, okay?
Yeah.
We've got to have some reality here. We need a reality check.
Yes.
And I do give the legislators credit for trying to push reforms.
Jim Waters and the Bluegrass Institute, we appreciate your report on all of this. And we're running out of time. God bless you, and tune in next week for the rest of the news.
Hi, I'm Dr. Frank Simon. I'm an allergist and family doctor, board certified in both allergy and internal medicine. I specialize in allergy, headaches, sinus, hives, cough, asthma, hypertension, and diabetes. We're located at 1404 Browns Lane near Norton Suburban Hospital. Our phone number is 895-5088. We can see you tomorrow.
Okay, welcome to the rest of the news. I'm Frank Simon, and our special guest is Ed Holloway. How you doing, Ed?
That's fine, Dr. Simon. Well, compared to everything else, I think we're doing pretty good.
Good, good. Now, there's a lot of controversy about the Stephen Paddock, the shooter in Los Angeles. Right. We have a video here of a gentleman from the FBI who is retired from the FBI. But he has a lot of information about that, and he thinks Paddock was a Muslim terrorist.
Right. Well, he thought he was influenced by it because if he did a study, and he's looked at it from an investigative standpoint, and he found 13 different areas where there are questions that are unanswered by anybody right now that lead him to believe that this man, for example, had never had any military training or anything else.
Yeah.
He had nothing to bring to the table with the knowledge of firearms.
Yeah.
And all of the things he has done, he's had to have influence from somewhere, somehow, and this is some of the points that he was making. John is his credentials are unbelievable. He was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He became a Marine officer. He was a combat leader in Iraq, well, in the Desert Shield, Desert Storm,
and all that.
Then became an FBI agent, and he was in counterterrorism. He studied, and he has been an expert on the thing. He ran a course about Muslims
Yeah.
And about what they're doing and everything else. And in 2004, the FBI had uncovered all of the documents in a house in Virginia that explained in detail how the Muslim Brotherhood attempted to plan to conquer America through what they called civilized jihad and all that. And then all that's been exposed. But during the Obama administration, one organization, I may point out, that made more visitations to the White House than any other group was the Muslim Brotherhood.
And brother, that tells you something right there.
And all of those things are things that have been neglected by the media and by the academic community and all of that. And it's guys like this that are exposing that.
Well, let's listen and see what he has to say.
Welcome back. Well, we are still a nation in mourning as to what happened in Las Vegas. And there's still a lot of attempt to find out the motive behind the shooter. Mr. Paddock, I'm delighted to have back with us today John Quandolo. He's the counter-terrorist expert, former FBI agent, founder of UnderstandingTheThreat.com, which is a website, UnderstandingTheThreat.com, and he's a co-author of a book of Sharia, The Threat to America. John, thanks for coming back. How are you, bud?
I'm well. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. All right, you put out a list. I was reading this list that suggests very clearly that the shooter, Mr. Paddock, may have been involved with radical terrorism. You got 13 points here. They're stunning. How'd you come up with this?
As an investigator, I think you learn, and I certainly learned, you weed out all the noise, you get to what you can put your hands on, the concrete, and then you look at that, and what does it tell you? I was stunned today to see that the FBI is now going to put up billboards to encourage citizens to call in and help them, when the answer is laying right in front of them. And as all the evidence comes in, it simply supports the assessment of that Understanding the Threat did hours after the attack.
We know that the Islamic terrorists took credit for this twice. I think they made it very public that Mr. Paddock had been radicalized by them. In addition, I should say, to your 13 points here that suggest that this could be the case, wasn't there recently brought out that he did travel to the Middle East?
Right, the evidence that we have certainly supports that this was a jihadi operation, but let me hit the point that you just made very clearly for your audience. The Islamic State has never claimed responsibility for an attack of this nature when they were not involved. So this would be if our government officials, our FBI, our law enforcement, if they're correct, then this is the first time ever that the Islamic State has claimed attack and it wasn't theirs. Now, there are one or two instances out there that some in the media are saying, but even Fox News and CNN have been putting out this narrative, a false narrative, that the Islamic State often claims things that don't belong to them. That's a lie. That's not true. That's simply false. So the fact that the Islamic State claimed this attack is not just some peripheral...
And he's got a lot of good points there.
Really has. And he has written a book called Raising a Jihad Generation, Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America. I have ordered a copy. I did a lot of background research on John after I saw that video. And in the process, I found that he's got unbelievable credentials